Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do it. Wait, book? What? Book? Well, we're not doing a recording, review of a book today. We're going to do a movie. Joining me for this discussion of a new movie that's just recently come out is Juliana. Say hello.
Hello.
And Juliana came with me today to the cinema, and we watched Interstellar. By Christopher Nolan, directed, and is it Jonathan Nolan who is the writer as well?
So I didn't check that.
I was going to say,
I just looked up who did the music.
It's obvious who did the music. It was very, very, very... Anyway, so what actually happened was like, hey, let's go and see Interstellar, because that's the big new movie, and everyone's talking about it. People go, oh, it's the best movie ever. Oh, but it was filmed in IMAX, or it was filmed in 70mm or 60mm, or whatever the IMAX format is. It was filmed with that, so you've got to see it on the big screen and the sound system, and all the big science fiction. We're like, okay, we only go to the cinema maybe 3 or 4 times a year, but we want to see those big movies. So we're like, yay, let's go tonight. And it was sold out, because this was last week. And then we're like, how about tomorrow? No, it's sold out, because there's only one IMAX theater in one IMAX screen in Berlin, which shows stuff in English anyway.
Yes.
So we booked our ticket for today, last week, a week in advance, and we were like, yes, and I've been looking forward to it for a while. Also, this has come up on a few other podcasts that I listen to. There's the Kermode and Mayo podcast from the BBC. They do film reviews, and they started this, and they were like pretty much like saying, okay, we're going to get into this, and we're going to try not to put any spoilers in there, but if you've not seen it, how about just not listen for a while? And I was like, okay. So I haven't listened to that. And also the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, they were also like, we're going to review Interstellar from a scientific point of view and a skeptical point of view, or whatever they do. And they've done that before for some of the movies, which is quite interesting.
So you haven't listened to that either?
Haven't listened to that either, because this is a movie that people said, just go into, don't listen, don't read any reviews, don't do anything, just go into it cold and you'll enjoy it a lot more. And so I'm glad I did. I'm glad I didn't know about the story. I mean, I knew the basic setup.
What did you know about it?
I knew that it started off and there was a food shortage on Earth, and they developed a space program to go and save humanity. That's literally all I knew. And I knew it had Matthew McConaughey in it. You remember when it came on before and there was a trailer and I just closed my eyes because I didn't want to see it. I hadn't even seen any trailer for it. All I've seen is the some images, you know, of like there's a black hole. And I've seen that, you know, the image of the black hole with a sun behind it or star behind
it. But you did know more story about it than I did, because I only saw the Kip Thorne interview and like how they developed the wormhole.
Yeah, that's what I saw as
idea.
Well.
But that was the only thing I knew about it. I knew it was a wormhole in it and a very scientifically correct image.
Yeah, well,
that was one.
I'm sure we'll talk about that more. So anyway. All of this setup to say is, I'm not going to let you know any. You, the listener. I'm not going to let you, the listener, know any more about this movie until you just go and see it. And it is worth going seeing. What do you think, Juliana?
Very much.
Yeah,
recommended.
People say, "Oh, it's the best movie I've ever seen." I'm not sure it's the best movie I've ever seen, but it's one of those things that it has to be. You kind of have to mention it. For any science fiction discussion now about science fiction in movies, it's gonna have to be there in the conversation about it.
Right.
You know,
yes.
Even to the point where, like, and this is what I said when I came out. You know, we talked about like the two things that we both didn't like about it, or the one thing that we both didn't like about it, and then one thing that you didn't like about it.
Yeah.
Just to get them out of the way as we came out of the theater, and then we're like, and now we are just gushing about it. And it is one of those things that, as I came out, I was like, that is a really ballsy move. To go, like, for a director like Christopher Nolan to go, okay, 2001, A Space Odyssey is generally considered the best science fiction movie of all time, one of the most influential movies of all time, you know, it's just a generally great thing. And it is one of my favorite science fiction movies. And it's got such an aura around it and such a legacy that for someone to go, I'm going to take that on. I'm going to head on address 2001, A Space Odyssey, because nobody else who's ever managed to do it since then has actually, you know, topped it, you know, has actually gone onto it and taken science fiction movie making up to that same level with like hard science fiction spaceships floating around in space. Even 2010, like the follow-up, doesn't reach that same level.
And also the epic scale of it, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The overall big meaning behind it.
I think there's better, like, small-scale science fiction movies where it's sort of, like, you know, just happening, like, on Earth, or, like, a dystopian or something. You know, like, one of the, like, a movie, like Alien, I think, you know, the first Alien movie. Again, that's another movie which is still influencing movies, like, all the way through to this day, and influencing cinema all the way through to this day. But even that kind of relied on 2001 for a lot of the things, you know, like the android going crazy in it, and the, you know, the voiceover computer and all that kind of stuff. Even that was like, I think it's a similar level of movie making and influence, but it's not like, say, the scale of this movie is huge. It's
huge. Just as the length of it.
And the length of it. Yeah, and that's another thing. So that's what I would say to anyone who hasn't seen it. Just think, if you really, really love 2001 A Space Odyssey, go and see this, because this is the closest you'll get to feeling, or not feeling the same, but also, if you really, really hate 2001 A Space Odyssey, and you're like, oh, I don't understand it, oh, why it takes so long at the start, this doesn't. It starts, it kicks off, the characters are there, you care for them, and all the way through to the end, there's not a slow moment. Like, in 2001, it is amazing, but there are some sequences where you just go, okay, how long do we actually have to watch that spaceship come down that thing? Like, are we going to listen to the whole of the Sprach Zarathustra again, just watching this spaceship coming down to land? Oh, we are. Oh, okay. So it's going to be a minute and a half of us watching this spaceship land. Okay, there's not none of that. There's none of that in Interstellar.
No.
I mean, there's a little bit of it.
Yeah, but not really. There's not a long stretch of us just having to watch something.
Yeah. Which is what you get in 2001. It's what you get in Solaris as well. You know, when we watch Solaris,
yes.
It's sort of like, and now a guy driving through a city. Why? I don't know. Just 5 minutes. Let's go. And you're like, really? Do we need all of that? Do we need all that? Now, in 2001, I do appreciate the slower pace of it. And even for when it was made, you know, in the time that it was made back in the 1960s, I think it was kind of more acceptable to, like, okay, this is epic, and we're making epic by length, not just by, you know, and length and visuals. And it's like, you've never seen a spaceship land before, because spaceships don't land. You know, it was all before the Apollo mission and stuff. And that was, and even that's mentioned in the start of Interstellar. Don't want to get into it too much. But yeah, it's one of those kind of things where you just go, Interstellar matches. Or, when we put it this way, I'm not sure if it matches it completely, but it's attempting, it's a director going, I want to match this level of scale and epicness and movie making and influence, and it's a really good go at it. Again, I think I'd have to watch it a few more times for me to be actually sure if it does hold up, but it's similar.
I think it is similar, but is also different.
Oh yeah, different, that's what I'm saying.
Which is, for me, because I think I didn't enjoy 2001 as much as you did. I think I had more problems with it.
I don't. It's not a question of enjoying it. It's a question of recognizing genius.
Yeah, it is. It is. I'm not saying anything against that, but Interstellar works also for more people.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's what I meant. If you love 2001, this is the kind of movie that is on that same scale. If you don't like 2001 for almost any reason, Interstellar improves on it in those ways for an audience. So that, all of that said, we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, maybe only another half an hour, but let's say go away and watch it and then come back in 5 seconds podcast time, or, you know, 3 hours real time after watching this, because really we're going to go into deep spoiler territory pretty much immediately, and you don't want to hear this before watching the movie. Really don't. Just go watch the movie. It'll be better in every single way not knowing anything going into it. So see you in a minute. And we're back. Everyone's gone and watched Interstellar. So now, if you're listening at this point, we're presuming we're going full spoiler mode. It's not like having to read a full book. It's not like having, we're going, oh, this book is like 20-hour audiobook, or it's going to take you three months to read the whole of Pandora's Star, or anything like that. It's nothing like that. It's just go for it. Just go.
Just almost 3 hours of your life.
Only 3 hours. So really, this time, stop listening, go away. And can then come back.
And do it like we did it. Just watch it start in the afternoon and then still...
Yeah, so...
don't go watch it in the late evening show. You will be a bit tired, maybe.
Yeah, maybe, and hungry.
And hungry.
Oh, yeah, that was the thing. Okay, so we presume we're all happy in spoiler territory now for the listeners. We went along and see it. And last time, what did we see last time? I can't remember what we went to see. It was... It was another big movie. I can't remember what it was.
Was it Edge of Tomorrow? No.
No, it wasn't Edge of Tomorrow. There was another one that we went to see. And we were like, hey, let's go to the cinema. And we're like, okay. And then we went out and we got the tickets already and we picked up the tickets. Then we went out for drinks. And then you came in and you'd bought yourself a massive stack of popcorn.
Yeah,
and
I thought it was a good idea.
And it wasn't. You didn't. And there was a massive gallon of juice.
It was horrible.
And it was like 10 euros for that. And by the time we finished, we're like, wait a second. We went out. We had a bit of food. We had like an ice cream, a drink, and then the cinema, and it was like, well, that's 50 euros gone already. Anyway,
we totally fell into the cinema trap at that point.
This time we didn't. I said, I am taking one bottle of drink and I'm not even going to drink that much of it because I'm going to need the toilet pretty much straight away. And guess what? The last 50, maybe the last hour of that movie, I needed the toilet. Now, in Berlin, they often have intermissions, and it actually said all Interstellar has an intermission except the 1 o'clock showing, which was our showing, and anyone that starts, I think if it started after 11 o'clock at night or something, it said no intermission then. So most people get a break halfway through. In a way, I'm pleased that we didn't, because it just kept on going.
It was good. I don't know where they would have put the intermission. I don't know.
Because I can't think of a good place. I think there's this section in the middle where it cuts back to Earth for the first time, and you know they start getting the messages where you get the fast forward from the Earth, where his son Tom comes on and gives a message, and then it's older Tom, and then married Tom, and then son has died Tom. Spoilers. Really, spoilers. And then I think that would be the point, because that's kind of where it slows down a bit. You know, that was that wave sequence.
Yeah.
And we picked up from there.
Probably.
So, okay, before we go into this, let's do it as we've just had a discussion coming out of the theater and as we got into the bikes and then came back. Let's just say the two things that we didn't like about the movie, and then we can start gushing about what we liked about the movie. So should we do that? And what we thought about it? There was one point in the movie where I was thinking, oh, this isn't going the way I want it to at this moment. And then Juliana came over and tried to grab me just because she wanted me to see her facial expression. Was that the reason you wanted to see me? You wanted to comment on me. You were like, this is rubbish. And I was thinking, this is really rubbish at this bit.
I was kind of starting to groan about it because it didn't fit into the movie.
Now, this is what happens sometimes when you watch a movie. You'll start moaning at me and I'm like, stop it. I'm like when we're watching Snowpiercer the other day.
I was just like, stop it.
I'm enjoying the movie. Stop trying to put your bad facial expressions in me, and that's why I kind of you reached over and touched my hand, and I just pushed your hand away. I was like, I know, I know, I'm thinking the same thing. And that was at the time when there was a big speech, and she's like, this is Anne Hathaway in the middle. It's like, oh, we've got to go to this planet. Why? We got to go there. And he's like, yeah, you're the person you love. And then she's like, and it's love that crosses the fifth dimension. Go on, what did you say about that?
Well, the thing is, this movie is really, it's the heart science fiction as science fiction can get. It's like really... They really go for all true physics, all true anything.
I wouldn't say true physics, I'd say as close as possible for the storytelling purposes as you can imagine.
And then suddenly someone starts, I wouldn't say whining, but I'm saying it. She started to whine about how great love is and, this is all cool.
Love will find a way.
I understand. Personally, I do understand that. On the other hand, my logical, hard science fiction brain says, shut up. What were you talking about? I mean, yeah, of course, love is great and stuff, but why would you pick some planet which has less chance to be the planet you are looking for if there is that person you met?
Okay.
As she said,
I understand why this is in the movie. I thought that was really misjudged, but it turns out to be true because the person that they actually went to see didn't love her, didn't have the best interest, had his own best interest in heart. So actually, the message was correct. In the long run, the message was correct. Yeah. Actually, relying on love, good, because actually the one person who loved you would be honest with you, and then this other... But at the time, there was no way to know.
He was dead.
Yeah, but there was no... Yes, but I'm just saying that the truth won out. Let me have a look here. So Matt Damon. Dr. Mann, who they were like, oh, Dr. Mann, he's the best guy. He's the one that we're all following. He's the greatest.
He's still sending signals.
He's still alive. You know, last time we knew he was still alive, and the data is fantastic. The data is going to be great. Let's go and go to him. And that was actually not true, but it was not true because he wasn't full of love. You know, that whole thing is like, when you die, like, what do you picture? You picture your family, you picture your friends. He didn't have anything like that. And actually said, all of these people who went away didn't have families. They were single.
Specifically.
And that's why Anne Hathaway was like, oh, no, but this one, that one person was true. You know, and that's why she had kind of, like, done things in that direction. But yeah, so the overall message that, oh, it's love that finds a way, and when you die, who do you think about when you die? Oh, it is. And when he falls into the black hole at the end, who is he thinking about? He's thinking about his, you know, daughter and his son or his family or whatever, and then, you know, connects up with them straight up. You know, thematically it works. Story-wise, it works. Logically, it kind of works in the world of the story. But acting-wise and scene-wise and in that scene, it's just like, what's going on? You know, it doesn't make sense. It's like, I think watching that scene back again, if you've seen the whole movie, it would be better. It will be better the second time through, because you'll be like, oh, yes, it does connect through, and this connects with that and there. But at the time,
point, it was just, I was a bit confused by that.
Yes, and I think it was unnecessary.
But apart from that, there was this one scene where, like, Luke says he doesn't think that it was the right way. When Cooper and the other guy. How's the other scientist called?
Which scientist?
Like the
There's the scientists were Matthew McConaughey, Cooper, and then there was Romilly, David Gaiosi, and then Wes Bentley as Doyle.
Doyle died earlier on the water planet.
On the water planet.
No, then I mean the other guy.
Romilly.
Romilly. So. Yeah. They both are approaching, when they approach the wormhole.
For the first time.
For the first time. He is, Romilly is asking Cooper to stop the spinning of the spacecraft.
And they do.
And he does. What in my head is, when the spacecraft is spinning, it creates gravity so that they can stand.
Yeah, but not where
they
are. They were in the cockpit of the ship, and the cockpit is in the hub. So when they're spinning, it doesn't actually create gravity for them. So spinning or not spinning, they don't get Earth-like gravity. They don't get 1G gravity. It's only on the outside of the hub.
But Romilly was standing on his feet. Like, he was acting normally.
But have you not seen 2001? They have sticky soles on their shoes.
No, in that one, they don't have them.
Oh, okay, that's true.
Anyway, so he was standing behind the pilot seat.
Yeah.
And Cooper was completely, like, in his suit and stuff, and Romilly was just in his normal clothes standing behind him and asking, can we stop the spinning? And I, in my head, thought, okay, when he stops the spinning, Romilly must be floating because it's then zero gravity.
But in that central section, there was never that much gravity. They always had to be strapped
Then why was he standing?
I don't know. I didn't notice that at the
time. I noticed that, and I thought that was weird, but maybe I just did see it.
Maybe
sort
didn't.
Wrong at that
the
point.
The thing, though, are all the gravity, are all of the different physics and stuff in this. What I like about it is what mattered to the story, and mattered to the special effects guys, and mattered to the stunt guys, and mattered to the, you know, storyboarders who actually construct out these action sequences. All of that stuff mattered.
Yeah.
You know, and they did it really well. There are a few things that didn't matter to this. For example, that my brother was complaining about. He's like, oh, but they have these shuttles which can just go up and down and, you know, up into orbit and down again. And they say they do that five times, and they didn't carry enough fuel to do that five times over. And so if they've managed to get rid of Newtonian physics that they can just fly up out of orbit, you know, up to orbit and back down again, that kind of stuff, I can give a buy. Any science fiction movie, I can give a few buys, like I can give them a few passes, free passes in terms of physics or storytelling or plot holes, but only if they don't affect the overall story.
Yes, right.
That's the thing that I really hated about the movie Moon, is that the story was about, we can clone someone and put them on the moon, spoilers, and then at the end of it, you know, it comes down to the point that the conspiracy is a self-defeating conspiracy. The reason why the conspiracy existed was defeated by the conspiracy itself. So even though there's lots of other really good stuff in that movie, like, there's even one point, it's, oh, he's on the far side of the moon, so he can't get a signal home. And then at the end, he just gets into a truck and just drives far enough around the moon to be able to see the Earth. And you're like, hey, wait, that doesn't work. You know, we read The Martian. It takes a long time to get across these places, and he just does it in, like, an hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, well, if he could have just driven an hour and then seen the moon, like, and seen from the moon to the Earth, line of sight, he could have done that at the start. Like, why didn't he just do it? You know, it's all these kind of things in that movie at the end where you just go, well, that's self-defeating. Whereas most movies don't rely on that kind of stuff, so I don't care about it. You know, yeah. Like, if a movie isn't about gravity and time, I don't really care about time frames not working out. And if it's about if it's a movie about gravity, the gravity has to, like, the movie Gravity, the gravity has to be really good. You can't have artificial gravity. Whereas a movie like Star Wars or Fifth Element or Guardians of the Galaxy,
yeah, but that's more fiction.
Well, it's not more fiction. The movie is not about how gravity works.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter that they have artificial gravity in the spaceships, because it's not about that.
And also, like, they don't explain how they are all doing it. They don't explain how they get the supplies. They don't explain how much fuel and how much oxygen and stuff they have.
They just talk about it. They mention it's like, we have this much stuff.
Yeah, they do mention it, but it's not a big issue. And they also don't explain how the sleeping thing does work. They are spending their time in this water floating thing. And I don't really felt like I have to ask about it, because it was just something embedded. It was just something it is in the future. It is in the future. So they just developed that.
Yeah.
And I don't need an explanation.
Again, it's well enough thought. Like I say, if enough of those small details work, you can give a big pass on the big details, you know. And you can see this time and time again with these movies and in books as well. Like, if the author or the scriptwriter or the set designer or the production designer, whatever it is, if they put in enough work into just a few details to make them really convincing, like the sleep tanks, you know, like when they do it and there's this plastic sheet that goes and they go down to the water. I've never seen sleep tanks in movies where there's water, and I really like that. Normally, like in Aliens, they just come out of a tank and they're like, oh, you know, and they tell the stuff, and I'm like, yeah, actually keeping someone in water is actually probably a much better way of keeping them long term. They might go a bit wrinkly, but it's not just wrinkly, it's like, you know, they don't dry out.
Exactly, they don't dehydrate.
Yeah, dehydrate, and you can kind of keep the, you know, different levels by just pumping different things into the water. You know, it's like, it's not like you're relying on the circulation, the blood circulation, to make sure parts of the body are getting what they want. You just kind of pump stuff to that part of the tank.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's those little details where you're just like, oh, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, okay. I can see that. Yeah.
Okay.
And the whole gravity thing with we're using a century. Oh, that was another small plot hole which I didn't understand. If at the end of it, plan A works because someone managed to work out how to manipulate gravity. And then at the end, they're in a spinning thing. And I'm like, wait a second. If you worked out how to lift up, you know, that NASA center, which they're actually building as a spaceship, and they're relying on being able to work out how to lift that whole thing up out of the air, you know, the launch pad. It's like, well, if the plan A relies on you sorting out gravity, why do you need a centrifuge at the end? Why can't you just manipulate gravity? So anyway, it's not a plot point. It's not a plot spoiler. It's just one of those things that just came to me at the end of the movie, you know, when I was like, oh, they've worked out how to manipulate gravity. And then they're in a spinning centrifuge. And I was like, well, why do we need a centrifuge anymore if they can do gravity?
But they need to manipulate gravity to get the thing off Earth.
Yes, but once you're off of Earth, if you're controlling gravity, like, why do you need a centrifuge at that point?
Well, because it's not that. Isn't there different sides of gravity?
Yeah, like I don't know.
There's the pulling down gravity, and there's the no gravity in the space that we have to
manipulate.
No, gravity
is just gravity. It's a single force of nature.
Oh, well, maybe.
One of the four fundamental forces of nature.
This is exactly why I'm not a scientist. And after watching that movie, you know what? I really regret that. In my future, when I get a child, I really push it to become a scientist. I want them to, like my children, to build this fucking space orbit thing and get us off this planet. I want this to happen, but I'm just not clever enough.
But on the other hand, watching this movie kind of makes you feel clever enough. You're like, I get this.
Exactly. That was what happened, because I thought, time is right. And then I was thinking, oh yeah, and when after the scientist man, after he
dies,
exploded there, and the whole thing was rotating so quickly that I thought, I had exactly the idea of how they could connect back onto it, because I thought, don't think that the space station is spinning, think that that everything around it is spinning.
Yeah, this is what I love about this. And this is what I love about this section of the movie. First of all, just want to say this. The way that Matt Damon dies is amazing in IMAX. It's just one of those things that I knew he was going to die at some point, but you know, and we were kind of discussing the cause of his death. In fact, the cause of his death at that point doesn't even matter, but just how he died, the violence of being inside an exploding spaceship.
Yeah.
seeing that in IMAX is one of those movie experiences where you just go, oh, you're like, oh, like that. And everybody in the cinema was just like, oh, shit. And then everyone knew what was going to happen.
Everyone shrugged. It was amazing.
And it's like there's that moment in Titanic where the guy falls off the back of the ship and on the way down.
Don't spoil it for me. I haven't seen it.
Titanic. No. There's just the moment in Titanic. He falls off the back of the ship and it's like the whole back of the ship is stuck in the air. He falls
and
down.
Into the propeller.
And he hits the ship propeller on the way down and he just goes smack around. And when I watched that in the cinema, everyone just went, and it is one of those moments, even to this day, when you think about the worst deaths, like not the worst deaths, but you know, that kind of surprising deaths, which you just go, it's not like a bloody death or someone being shot or just someone exploding. It's one of those things where you just hit it and you just go, that is a way of somebody dying on screen that I've not seen before. And in this moment in Interstellar, I think it's really super effective. But it and is. Then they have to go up, capture it. A perfect lesson in relativity, like you said.
Awesome.
Which I think is really
felt
clever.
So good.
You get
but then, immediately, my brain started working. So did Luke's.
Yeah,
right?
I'm like, so they're going to capture it, they're going to clip on, and then they're going to slow down this massive, heavy rotating thing in this lander with the jets, and all of the force to slow that down is going through there. But then I was thinking, actually, oh, maybe they're not just using that, but now they've connected up to it. Maybe they can control the jets on board or something
like that. Because it looked like they were all just controlling the rotation by pushing the air out of that.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I was like, that's a lot of force to exert in the center. You know, just leverage. You know, you've got your leverage. If they were on the outside and they managed to connect it and then they were like this and blasting a blaster on the outside, but they didn't have it.
I mean, this would be something that a physicist or a mathematician could probably just say, okay, they were spinning 700 and something meter per whatever second or something.
Revolutions per minute,
And then how much air would you need
To be honest,
this...
in that it looked a lot more than it is. But then, in my science fiction book, Mining Tomorrow, the way that they spin it up is that they don't use that. They actually put all the energy into a spinning flywheel. You know, when they actually slow it down, they use electric motors to put it into a spinning flywheel, which is then spinning extra fast. And then when they want to spin the spaceship up again, they just reverse it and just, you know, put the brakes onto the flywheel and then it spins it back up again. Okay. But of course, that's my own way of dealing with that project.
Well, that was the only time I was asking myself, how much oxygen tanks do they have?
Yeah, how much fuel do they have? But otherwise, I kind of gave them a pass on all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, things that we really liked about it. First of all, I really liked all the stuff on Earth at the beginning. I thought that was all really clever. I liked the idea that, they faked the moon landings back in the 1960s to bankrupt the Russians, and they did a really good job and they succeeded, but now we don't need to worry about that because it never really happened. And I was like, this is really clever. And later on I was thinking, that's really clever, because who was it who is said to have helped the NASA fake the moon landings? Stanley Kubrick. And it's using the technology that was developed for the 2001. Yeah, this is a whole part of the... Stanley Kubrick who faked the moon landings. And so it's one of those things that you kind of watch it and later on you go, oh man, there's so many references to 2001 here that you're just like, yeah. The first big reference to 2001 came, and this was all the way through then, it came when he goes down and they're talking about dust on plates and he looks out the window and just over the thing, and this organ note chord came.
Yeah, organ.
And I'm like, that is, like I say, the now what we think of as the 2001 Space Odyssey theme, the... was it Strauss, is it?
Yeah, Richard Strauss.
Richard Strauss. That is so recognizable as the climax to any scene in 2001, that lingering organ... Mm. is always punctuates the end of it. And what I really liked about the music is that this happened a few times, but then he started playing with it, that it would come in and it wasn't at a big climax of a spaceship coming down or anything, and then sometimes it would go like that and then there was suddenly another little theme came over the top and I was like, oh, that's really clever, just that little organ. It's
yeah,
not just pure organ.
The music was all through the movie super clever, except there was this one moment where it really came to me that it was a bit too weird when Cooper watched the one message of his son and then it cut off and then music cut off.
No, because the video stopped and the music just cut off and you're like,
and you think, was the music in the video?
Yeah, well, that's what I really liked about it. It's one of those things where you have to be super confident that you're not going to upset the audience. You're like, and it's always that thing, it's sort of like, why is there music in this movie? Where would the orchestra stand to watch it? Yeah. It's like, it's like, where would the camera be? Where would all this kind of stuff be? But in that moment, I was just like, that is a daring use of soundtrack. That's yes. a daring use of sound, which most, and in other times, the soundtrack was kind of overwhelming what they were saying. The sound and the, you know, maybe it was just because we were in an IMAX, but it kind of, it was overwhelming the speech sometimes, yes. and sometimes it was backing up. And other times when stuff was happening, you were like, this is just this, these two notes are like, you know, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but it was just these themes coming over like so often that were just like, I don't know. I think Hans Zimmer is very clever. Sometimes I think the music was a bit overblown, but for a music like this, where you're literally saying, okay, we're going to do 2001. We need a score which matches the epicness of that
exactly.
with the Blue Danube and
what,
the
just
2001
imagine,
theme.
Just think about it. What is the most epic musical instrument that human developed, that humans have? It is?
Computer.
The organ.
Oh, the organ. Oh, okay.
It is the organ. It has the highest, deepest, smallest,
bone rattling notes,
lowest, whatever you want, and it can fake human voices. It can fake other instruments. This is just the most epic instrument that we have, and he used it so much.
Yeah,
and
but it's
great.
It's amazing that whole you know, the Also Sprach Zarathustra uses one organ. One note. I mean, it's that chord at the end.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that the organ has played. I think Bill Bailey, who's a comedian, he does this thing, and he did this like orchestra, like comedy orchestra thing, and he played the organ part of that. And literally, he waited all the way through to the end, and then at the right moment, he holds down those two notes.
Yeah.
And this is at the Royal Albert Hall. I think I saw a recording of him, and he just holds it down like that, and everyone goes out, and then he just goes, "Thank you." And then he comes down round to the front and actually yeah. starts the show. But that's the kind of thing where it's that one moment, this is what I was saying before about Victor Key's juggling show. Mm. Nobody in the podcast listening to this. Anyway, Victor Key's got an amazing act, and then he made a new act. Like, he did this great act that was his own one that he performed with Cirque du Soleil, and then he came up with a new act. And I'm like, well, how do you top the act? You've already got one of the best juggling acts in the world, ball juggling act. How do you top that? How do you go even bigger? And he's like, oh, all I'll do is I'll take the finale, like the opening and the finale moments, which are the most iconic, and I'll make that iconic moment the whole movie, if that makes sense. Like, and that's what this old juggling act, you know, with the
whole, which is when is it a movie?
But, you know,
the thing is
what he does, he reaches up and balls drop down from the sky into his hands, and it's this amazing, magical moment, and you're like, wow, this is
and they
really...
drop on cue. Like,
yeah, they drop on cue. But in his first act, that happened once, and it was really impressive. Like, he throws he was threw the balls away, and then more balls dropped down. That happened once in his first act. His next one, he was like, oh, let's just do that all the way through, and then at the end, fire. And this is what you kind of get with this, you know, with this soundtrack. You're like, oh, what's the most epic thing, you know, like that epic moment? It's just that last that note being held for a long time and keeping an image for a long time and keeping the tension for a long time. And then they're like, okay, let's use that as the inspiration for the whole soundtrack. And I was very impressed by that. Other things we're impressed by?
The story. I was really impressed by the story because I had no idea what the story actually was about. I didn't know when it was starting. I kind of thought, oh, well, this guy's a bit mumbly. He's a bit... Mm. And then the further it kept on going and the further it established this whole story about it, I felt so engaged in it. And I really, really enjoyed going along and it was just never a time issue. I never felt like, oh, this is long.
Yeah.
Holy shit, this is 3 hours. Oh, I can't deal it anymore. No, this whole story was just constantly moving, and it wasn't there wasn't any, like, when they reached the planet where Dr. Mann was on, I was thinking, oh, well, that is not the planet they are looking for.
No.
Really,
but
not.
It was kind of obvious that it wasn't.
It was kind of obvious, but then it plays out so well, and I don't know, it was just the whole thing. End is just, oh, so good.
Yeah, I liked it when Matt Damon turned up, and I was like, oh, I didn't even know who was in the movie. You know, I knew Matthew McConaughey was in it.
I didn't know he was in it.
I knew Matthew McConaughey was in it, and I knew...
I didn't know Anne Hathaway was...
Some of the main stars, like Michael Caine I knew was in it, Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. I think that's all I'd known about. And then these other actors turned up, like, his son suddenly grows up and he's Casey Affleck, and I was like, oh, it's Casey Affleck. You know, it was only when his name came up that I could remember his name, but I was like, oh, that's the Affleck one. And then... And then when Matt Damon turned up, I was like, oh, I didn't know he was in here. And I was like, oh, but it's Matt Damon. He wouldn't just have a small part. Yeah, he's going to have an important, like, important part.
Yeah.
Like, and it's when these, when like an actor who's like a big name actor turns up, you know that if they're the bad guy, they, or if they, they just turn
if
up,
they turn up
through,
not being the main people,
they're going to be important. Mm. And if they're going to be the bad guy, they're going to have a really epic death.
Yes.
And like I say, his epic death was pretty good. There was some other good things. Oh yeah. Just Murphy as well. That's something that annoyed me. Murphy's law is not that if something can happen, it will. That's actually Sod's law. Murphy's law is if there's two ways to do something, and one way leads to disaster, someone will pick the other name.
It is like pick the other queuing one. Up in the supermarket, and you always pick the longest.
Yes, you pick the longest queue.
Or
but it's not like you drop
a toast, and the toast obviously falls down.
Yeah, if there's two ways that something can happen, one way leads to disaster, someone will pick the way that leads to disaster, you know, that's always the way. Anyway, Murphy, Mackenzie Foy as young Murphy, grew up into Ellen Burstyn, and I didn't know that she was going to be a main character. I thought, oh, goodbye. I mean, I knew it was going to be come back to her because of the, you know, the poltergeist at the start.
Yeah, I kind of knew that she would become a scientist. That was so clear.
But I didn't know how much it was going to be about time accelerating and them growing up, and maybe I'll come back as the same age as you. I was like, oh, that's clever, but I didn't realize that's the direction the story was always going to go in. You know, I thought him coming back to the same age, I thought that would be the end of the movie. Like, everything would play out, and then he'd come back, and they would be the same age, or she'd be older, actually, which is what happens at the end. I thought that was going to be. I didn't realize there was going to be this crossover part in the middle where he's, you know, connecting back with her at that age, at that time.
Yeah.
But when she grew up, I was like, holy shit, those actresses, you know, Ellen Burstyn and Mackenzie Foy, they could literally be sisters or mother and daughter or the same person. You know, that is one of the most convincing changes from child actor to adult actor. And this is what I was saying before we started recording. It's one of those times when normally when there's a child actor and then an adult actor, normally it's the adult actor who's the real actor, and then when you see the child version of them, you're like, oh well, they just found a child actor who looks a bit the same. But in this, it's like, no, the child actor is doing the heavy lifting of the character development.
She's
and
as
the character
important.
More important because it's actually that young character which pushes the action through the movie. It's reliant on this 10-year-old girl. Actually, I don't know how old she was when they were filming, but she says she's meant to be 10 years old. I left my 10-year-old daughter behind. That's really cool. The voice acting for the robots was really good. Let's talk about the robots. Did you like the robots?
I like the robots. They at the beginning, I thought, oh well, these robots are a bit clumsy. They just didn't really see them.
Yeah.
They're just blocks, and they walk in this weird way where they have these four blocks, and then they just stretch out. And I thought, oh,
more blocks than
they can't really walk very quickly. Turns out.
They can. and I was thinking, I thought it'd be weird. I was like, well, how do they clap? Like, is everything just these sections that go in and out? And you realize as it goes on, oh, they've actually got
sections.
The more sections, and there's even smaller sections. Like this fractal thing, as you'd get deeper into it, there's more and more fractal parts. Which does remind me of a science fiction book that I read once, which there was this robot which had like a bulb head, and then it's lower section was just like a column, but it actually wasn't a column. It was fractally made, where it would split into two, and then each one of those would split into two, and each one of those, you know, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what we had here. But I was thinking, why is it a block? First of all, I think it's a block because it brings back the monolith from 2001. It's another reference to that.
Yes.
And them not having a face and just having a screen is very much a HAL kind of moment. But them all breaking into sections and then kind of going back together into that slab, I think is a really good thing because they're meant to be ex-military. You know, you see these things like that drone flying around at the start. You're like, oh yeah, this is Indian design. And you're like, that's not an Indian design. That's an American drone design. But okay, he gets the brains out of him, puts them in. But then later on, when you actually see NASA using these robots, oh, these are ex-military robots, but they're going to go with them. It's like, okay, if it's a military robot, what do you need? You need sturdiness. You need ruggedness. And if something can collapse itself down into a single block and just lay there on the ground, you could drive over that thing in a tank and it would still be good. Whereas lots of science fiction robots are they look really flimsy, you know.
Yeah.
And this wasn't too, either they look too anthropomorphic, so they look like a human, but like the Terminator.
Yes.
But I mean, that's done for a reason. The Terminator is done
but
for a reason.
But then you know, okay, there's a human in the
Yeah, side. It's a human in a suit. And this is one of those robots where you just go, oh, they haven't just gone, let's get a man in a suit. Or, if not a man in a suit, let's get a device which is completely, I don't know, it's just like, let's rethink what a robot could be. And if it was a military robot, and the most important thing is that a bomb can go off next to it and it'll be perfectly fine, what shape do we need it to be?
Yeah.
We need it to be a slab and let's work our way up from there. So yeah. I like that. However, there was this thing. What is there evil out there in the world? No, is nature evil? No, the only evil is the evil we take with us. And I'm like, oh, it's hell. We're going to get hell. And then there's this great moment where she sends a message. She's like, Murphy sends a message to, actually I should bring it up here, sends a message to Anne Hathaway, Brand, isn't it? It's like, Brand, and then she's like, your father's dead. And you knew about this, you knew that plan A was a joke all the way along, there was never going to be a plan A, it was all about plan B. And she sent that message, she kind of leans forward and almost turns it off before she sends that, and then she sends it and it gets it, and one of the robot picks it up. And I was like, he's not sending on the message. And then later on he does send it on, and it starts playing, and I was like, is it going to stop? Because this is the key thing. If the robot stops the message at this point, we know that the robots are evil and they've been programmed in the alien way to, like, yeah, the mission is more important than
the
humans.
And that is also the 90% honesty and 10% lie.
Yeah, and you're like, is this going to be it?
Is this going to be the 10% lie?
Yeah, and it turns out, no, actually, the robots weren't Hal. The robots weren't cool. Bishop from Alien. They were on the side, and in the end, they become heroes. And all the time, they're hero figures. And you're like, it's so good that it's not the humans aren't the ones. Like, and now we've got to get out of the situation. Who are we going to sacrifice? It's going to be the human. And it's, you know, like at the end of,
but they work together.
Yeah, they work together. But like at the end of a lot of things, it's like, oh, let's get the main character to sacrifice himself for his family. You know, like at like Armageddon, and it's Bruce Willis. It's like, no, Ben Affleck, you get back in there. I will sacrifice myself. And in this case, it was like, we're going to send in the robot. Why? Well, we just order it to. It's like, that's their job. It's like, okay. And then at the end, in this movie, Matthew McConaughey isn't the one doing the hard work, isn't the one, say, with the plan that they made. They sent in the robot to do the hard work. Anne Hathaway goes on to save the day. And Matthew McConaughey was just like, well, I'm just dead weight. We got to get rid of this. Like, this is used up now. I'm just sending you on. And I thought that was really great that, oh, actually, the tool that they used, which was the robot, is the right way to do. They use the tools, and it's not always humans who win out in the end. In this case, the robots were the ones, like, they sent the robot in, and in the end, the message that he did back in Morse code, that wasn't his message. No, it was the robot.
It was the robot helping him out there. And this is also something I really enjoyed about the movie, is I talked to you about that before, that it has a proper ending. It is not like just a weird kind of, okay, now he gets sucked in the wormhole and dies.
Yeah.
Well, this would be something. This would be something in now physics theory would happen. If you go into a wormhole, you will die. They don't know how, but you will.
Well, a black hole anyway.
A black hole or whatever, any kind of hole. Of course, you will just be dead. But here, I really liked it that they played out all the little details of the movie all the way along, and put it all together, and then have a really cool ending where when he wakes up at the end, and I thought for a second, oh no, this was it. They will just say,
it was all
just a bad dream because he had this accident with his
spaceship
at the start, and it was all for nothing. Turns out, no. And nope. I was very, very, very glad.
But again, him waking up in that white room at the end, I was like, oh, look, another 2001 reference. I mean, they kept on coming through. Yes, I did like the endings. But it was at that point where, you know, at any point in the movie, you could just stop the movie and it's like, that could be the ending. That could logically be an ending.
Exactly.
And there was a few things which they didn't come back to at the end. Like, I thought it was really great that they said, oh, you go off and find this person again. I was like, but there was that guy who was on the planet with a wave and they just left him there and he wasn't dead. He got hit by a wave, but he didn't die. He got washed away. And I was just like, well, we know that time travel goes by a lot slower on that planet. They could come back and it would only have been a few hours or maybe a day past for him. He could still be alive. You know, a few more waves go past, but he could still be alive.
And I'm sure at the end when he goes out to find Brand, I'm sure
he could go back to that planet.
Yeah, and, I mean, sure they would then also just look there.
But it was so weird that they finished that sequence and they flew away and it's like, yeah, they're safe. The other guy didn't make it, but they flew away and they're safe. And then it just shows a shot of him laying down in the water and you're like, holy shit. And then it's left up to us to realize that he is still alive. Now he's still alive. At the end of the movie, 100 years have gone by back on Saturn or back on Earth or wherever they've gone to.
Saturn, then near Saturn.
Yeah, but are there still people back on Earth? I'm just saying in the solar system, in our real world, by one of the watches. Yeah, it's one of those things where you just go, oh, that could still that could still make sense. And there was another point when they were looking at the watches, like, our watches, we'll come back and we'll compare the watches at the end.
Yeah.
And then there was a watch was fiddling. And I was like, oh, they're not. There's nothing, something in the watch. It's not a magic watch, is it? And I was like, no, oh, that's going to be really...
I thought there was something magnetic going on.
Yeah, well, we knew it was gravity, but he was using gravity to do that. Like, he was him hitting the bookshelves at the back and fiddling around with his hands.
Yeah.
He was doing stuff with gravity at that point. But there was this thing with the watch. I was just like, that's no... Uh-huh. It's not just going to be a magic watch. And in the end, it was a lot cleverer than being a magic watch.
It was
really another thing which I thought was really good is just the design of the movie. Like the look of the spaceships I thought was really great, because it feels like when it opens up, you just see a little space shuttle on this bookshelf. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then all the design stuff from then on was, it's like a cross between NASA space shuttle stuff and 2001 A Space Odyssey technology level.
Yeah, it does totally look very convincing, futuristic space stuff.
But not really futuristic. It's more 1980s space stuff.
Yeah, but not like too fiddly and too like lots of stuff hanging around. I mean, if you look at the ISS right now, it is just crammed. It's just like things hanging, things being attached,
it's strapped
things
on.
Strapped.
Well, you
things.
Kind of got that when they landed on that ice planet and met Matt Damon. You know, where they went in there, you're like, oh, this has been lived in for a few years, hasn't it? But also, not just the design of spaceships, but just them going through the wormhole is spectacular.
It is
really amazing. And then the black hole, just that look of the black hole. You're like, there's a sun with a black hole in front of it. Next to it, you're never quite sure what you're looking at. When they first came through and you saw the sun, I was like, the sun is there. You know, because there was this lens flare and then the sun came on screen. I was like, there's a black thing in the sun. How could there be a black thing in the sun? And at that time, I didn't know there was going to be a black hole right there. And there was. And you're just like, wow. And going into the black hole is amazing. And then the bookshelves in the end where they go into that infinite
loop. It just looks so amazing.
It is. And it's one of those things that you just go all the way through. It's all been grounded. Well, not grounded in reality, but kind of it feels there's not been any fantasy. And then that moment comes up and you're like, oh, yeah, this is by the guy who came up with Inception. You know, all the imagery in Inception with, you know, the
repeating.
Yeah, the repeating stuff. You're like, oh, this is the Inception
moment.
You look
down into a mirror of a mirror of a mirror of a mirror.
But it's not, you're not looking into space, you're looking into time. That's the impressive thing. The other thing that I want to bring up, just before we finish up, we got to finish up soon. Just the storytelling is, and this is why I find Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan, the writers of this, they must have just so much confidence in themselves that they're going to tell these complex stories in this really... like complex way, and then just thinking not just that the audience is going to go along with it, but the audience is going to be really happy with it. And I understand why not. Now, there was a section at that came in once they started talking to Matt Damon, and they're talking to Matt Damon, and then suddenly we cut back across and we're seeing young Murphy, older Murphy doing stuff. You know, they get that message that this person has died, and it comes backwards and forth. And then it goes, oh, this is... And then it kept on cutting backwards, and there's a thing where they go and meet the brother, Tom again, the son, you know, Tom. And then and it starts cutting backwards and forwards between the dramatic scenes with Matt Damon and them setting up and going on all that kind of stuff. And I was like, are they just doing this because it's like they're just setting up a new base on the ice planet and it's not actually that exciting? And then I was like, no, it isn't. Because this is a movie about time, and this is where it's going to start linking up. There's going to be a time-dependent thing that they're going to have to reference back to each other. There has to be something that's working against the clock. And as it happened, it just went on and on, and it was like 40 minutes of the movie going back, you know, back to Earth, and then across here, and it's happening in the same time, you know, it's, you know, in real time it's happening. Yeah. This is happening there, and at the same time this is happening back on Earth, and this is happening there, and this is happening, and I was like, how are these two things going to connect up? And I was like, there is no way. Why are they, what's going on? When is this going to connect up? And it just went on and on and on, and then they do this thing, and they shoot off, and they capture the spaceship, and then they go in, and then he falls into the black hole, and then I was like, and then it got to that point, and he looks back, and is like, now it's all making sense. But it wasn't just making sense then. It kind of, I knew what was going to happen, that there was going to be a link up back to Earth, because otherwise, dramatically, it didn't make sense to have this switching backwards and forwards. But I'm just saying, the discipline that it takes for a movie maker to just go, well, not for the movie maker, but like the movie maker says to the audience, we're going to start switching backwards and forwards between these things, and you're going to find out why in 35 to 40 minutes time, but stick with me with this. And he did it, and it pulled through. And in the end, it makes a lot of sense. You know, it actually works out.
I didn't question it once.
You didn't question it once?
No.
You didn't realize that it was all leading up to a moment where she had to be in the right place at the right time, and he's going to work out.
Of course, leading up to that moment, but it makes sense. And I really wanted to see what was going on with them on Earth. I really.
But why would you? Why did you have to see it at that moment? All the rest of the time, it had just gone backwards and forwards between them.
Obviously, it was a time thing that it has to happen at the same time.
Yeah, but why at that? Like, why? That's the thing. Why was it happening at that time?
As you said, it was. Oh, shit. This okay. is my student
so,
coming.
Anyway, that's what we have to finish it up there. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye.
And we had a good 40-minute discussion on that one. Let's wrap it up there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. And Juliana, follow us on Goodreads. That was a special episode. We'll do this and a half episode. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time. We'll catch you next time. Both of us will be back sometime.